All the big issues of the day are right there in your cup of coffee. We're talking issues like globalization, immigration, women's rights, pollution, and self-determination. So pull up your easy chair, fasten your seatbelt, because we're going to pour it all out of your cup of coffee.
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 574th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Lago Como who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels.
Glad to be here.
Also, producers Carol Stafford and Parmalee Taff are working the phones for us today. Folks, there are 28 million people growing coffee around the world, but 99% of those who drink coffee have never met a single coffee farmer. Today, we're going to change that as we go Java trekking with Dean Sikon, who's the author of Java Trekker, Dispatches from the World of Fair Trade Coffee, and also the proprietor of Dean's Beans in Orange, Massachusetts. Dean, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael.
Gosh, Java trekking. Why didn't you call it Joe trekking?
Huh. Well, Java is one of the original places where coffee was grown.
Right.
When the Dutch broke the monopoly of the Turks over the coffee that was grown in Ethiopia and Yemen, they planted in Bavaria, which is Java. And so the first name for coffee was actually Mocha, from the port of Mocha, where it came from in Yemen. And the second type of coffee was called Java, from Java. And the first blend was called Mocha Java.
Mocha Java. Were they two different kinds or two different genuses of coffee?
No.
Arabica and Robusta?
Well, not at the time. They were Arabica or Arabica is grown in the Arabian area,
mm-hmm.
and that was transplanted over to Java for growing in plantations. And Robusta was found in Africa as a low-lying, low-elevation plant. Those are the two genuses.
Okay, what kind of coffee do we drink when we visit your place?
Well, 99% of specialty coffees, or, you know, gourmet is kind of like an overused word, so specialty coffees,
right.
99% of them are Arabica, but there are some really outstanding Robustas out there, but you got to find them. We have, and several other people have, too. But Robusta, by and large, is what's used as sort of the filler in the canned coffees you find in the supermarket.
So those big orange cans of Folgers coffee that we used to drink by the gallons, is that different than the specialty coffees we're drinking today?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's absolutely different. It's tends to be a much lower altitude coffee, so it doesn't have the quality. And obviously, they pay a heck of a lot less for it, which is why you can get a can of coffee in the supermarket for $4.
So that would be the kind of coffee I drank in the Navy then, right?
Yeah, I think they cut it with diesel fuel in the Navy.
Right. Yeah, no fun at all coffee. we're talking high-altitude coffees then, aren't we? We're talking about the difference between something that's grown in the lowlands and something that's grown in the highlands. And does this kind of parallel the wine world, wherein the best wine grows on the slopes and in the knotty soils, and the worst wine comes from the beautiful, flat, fertile valley floor?
Well, there is a parallel, because any agricultural product is going to be a reflection of its environment. And so the soil characteristics, whether they're volcanic or sandy, whether they hold water or not, the surrounding environment, what kind of nutrition goes into the soil, what kind of shade is provided, all of those things, the altitude, whether it's on a south or north slope, all of those things bring out a certain character in each coffee, which is why so many coffees around the world have such completely distinct characteristics. Unlike wine, though, coffee is processed and manipulated several times before you drink it, whereas wine goes through the processing at the vineyard, and that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. Or at the winery, at least.
Yeah.
Right. So tell us about those processes while we're at it here.
Well, coffee is picked. It's a cherry. It looks like a cherry.
And I just recently had the opportunity to visit a coffee plantation in Kona, Hawaii, where there were still some ripe cherries on the trees, and they really do resemble cherries.
Yes, they are. They're red.
They're red.
They look like cherries. They're a fleshy fruit, and the process is that the farmer takes them and generally soaks them in water, which then the ones that are dead, as they say, float to the top and get rid of them. Soaks them in water for 24 hours, and that starts the fermentation process. Then they strip off the cherry, which reveals almost like a peach pit kind of mucusy.
Do they do anything with the fruit, by the way?
It depends. The majority of the farmers in the world, especially the large farms, basically throw them out, and they become somewhat toxic in nearby lakes and rivers because of the certain toxicity of the bean. Some people turn it into wine, coffee wine, but that's not a blossoming industry yet, pardon the pun. And others in the organic industry, people are required to take that pulp and mulch it and compost it and put it back into the plant, because that natural toxin is also a good pest repellent.
Huh, interesting. Okay, good.
So the coffee goes from there, then it's set out in the sun where it's dried to a certain moisture level, like 14% moisture.
And on the island of Kona, of course, out in the sun was underneath plastic tarps because of the rain. So they kind of had little shelters where they dried.
There you go. Some of the farmers around the world, it's as if they read Popular Mechanics. They set up these drying beds and then cover them with clear plastic.
Right.
And plastic. Yeah. Just out of Popular Mechanics.
Uh-huh.
And they dry that for a day or so, and then it's what it is there are two little coffee beans inside, nestled together like twins, inside a paper parchment, and that parchment is then stripped away in a milling machine, revealing the two beans. So all that is what it takes to get that dried coffee bean that then gets shipped up to us. We roast it, manipulate the characteristics in the roaster, and send it on to the market.
Then let's talk a little bit about the nature of the enterprise. Is coffee growing divided into kind of like industrial scale coffee growing and then the specialty growers who are smaller and more fragmented?
Well, it is broken up. It's not quite the way you stated it. Let me go through it. There are large plantations and smaller farms. There are family farms of, 10 to 20 acres, and then there are even smaller farms of half an acre. And so the majority of the farmers in the world are these half-acre guys, half-acre families, and they're the most marginalized. And then you have the large plantations, which sometimes are owned by, some powerful families in the state. That tends to be the case. And they have more access to credit. They use a lot of pesticides. It's more mechanical.
Right.
So you've got the artisan coffees from the small growers on one end of the spectrum and the large plantations on the other end of the spectrum, and there's everything in between.
So it does parallel kind of wine, does it not?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And it is labor intensive, is it not?
Absolutely. There are very few operations that have mechanical harvesting, because you have to pick the harvest may be over the course of 2 months, and that tree may produce, that bush may produce 30 pounds of coffee, but the berries mature at a different rate. So you really need hand picking to go over that same plant 6, 7, 8 times over the course of the 2 months to capture all the berries at their ripest.
So that it's all similar to
mechanical harvesters for the lower quality coffee go in there and basically shake out any, they shake the tree and whatever falls off. Hopefully it's the most ripe berries.
Yeah, so then it does parallel the strawberry industry as well, which requires hand picking. You have to go in and look and see which berries are ripe, and then those are the ones you pick, and you leave the green ones for later.
Yes, and like the strawberry industry, it's massively chemical intensive, unless you're involved in organic agriculture. The larger farms rely very heavily on 10 quite toxic chemicals.
And that would include herbicides to knock down those tropical weeds and
herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers. Everything from DDT, malathion, parathion, endrin, dieldrin. many of the things that are banned or are very strictly limited use here in the States.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Got a cup of coffee on that one, huh?
Yep.
Now let's talk a little bit quickly before we have to go to a break, which we're going to do really quickly here. But this is a tropical enterprise, essentially, of poor people, right?
Primarily, yeah. There are a few well-off coffee farmers in the world. Well, you mentioned Kona, for example.
Right.
That's an American landscape, so it's quite different economics. But the 90%, 95% of the farmers in the world are quite poor.
Okay, we're going to pick that up when we come back and see how we can make them less poor. Michael Olson here. This is The Food Chain. We're talking with Dean Sykin, who's the author of Java Trekker, Dispatches from the World of Fair Trade Coffee, and the proprietor of Dean's Beans in Orange, Massachusetts, and you, 831-479-1080. And we have Edwin Martinez calling in from Guatemala as well. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey, welcome back. Michael Olson here. This is The Food Chain. Today we're talking about the world of coffee. You know, folks, every time you pick up coffee and put it to your lips, you're sipping on a world of human activity that includes some of the great issues of our day, including poverty and the developing world and globalization and women's rights and just about everything. And today we're looking into that cup of coffee and seeing what's really involved. And with us today, we have a couple of guests. We have Dean Sykin, who's the author of Java Trekking, an incredible story of trekking, as it were, the world's coffee regions, which tend to be some of the world's most exotic places. And also with us today, we have Edwin Martinez, who's calling in. He's a coffee grower in Guatemala. So we hope to have a very interesting conversation. Of course, you're invited to participate as well today. Our phone numbers are 800-624-2665 for those of you across the country. And for those of you here on California's Central Coast, 831-479-1080. Dean Sykin, we were talking a little bit about the poverty in the coffee-growing portions of the world. Why the poverty?
Well, largely because coffee is a commodity. It's an agricultural commodity, and the price for the commodity is not set by the farmers in a fair hand-to-hand exchange, like for a guy who has a hardware store. You know, he brings in a product, and he adds his initial cost, his administrative cost, reasonable profit, and he offers it at that price. The farmer doesn't have that option. The world market price is set in the New York Board of Exchange, largely, Board of Trade, rather, New York City, in a place called The Ring, where traders, like stock traders, bid up and bid down the lifeblood of the coffee farmer.
Who you call the Lords of the Ring.
I call them the Lords of the Ring, because I love the movie. Uh-huh. But they do. They have the power, basically the power of whether or not a farmer is going to have enough food for his family or enough profit to reinvest into the farm the next year. And those prices were fairly stable back in the 90s because of an international agreement on coffee, on both a sort of a price band and also a production band. Well, that fell apart in the 90s under the free trade regimes. And when that happened, speculators got into the coffee markets because coffee had always been a rather dull commodity because of these limitations, quotas, and price bands. And then when that was lifted, the speculators said, yet another thing we can make speculative money on, buying and selling futures. And so a really raging market was created. And at the same time, the World Bank had helped Vietnam get back on its feet by using coffee. And so the around the same time, the world became flooded with Vietnamese Robusta coffee, and that really knocked the legs out from under the price, because there was so much more supply than demand. And that led to a pricing crisis where, during the beginning of the new millennium, farmers were receiving, in many places, receiving less than the cost of production, which means if it took me 65 cents to grow and process this crop, and I'm only getting 40 cents or 50 cents back, every time I sell a pound, I'm getting deeper in debt. That led to about 1 million farmers around the world losing their land and becoming economic refugees.
What relationship did that have with something called the death train?
For the economic refugees coming up from all over South and Latin America, there's a choke point where Guatemala meets Mexico, and there are several small towns or cities there, and one of them is Tapachula. Tapachula is right on the Guatemalan-Mexican border, and it's where a train that takes bulk oils and cement from that border north to the U.S. border originates, and many people, to this day, by the hundreds, many people get on that train and just sort of, not as paying passengers, get on top of the bulk carriers and sort of ride the trains towards the north as part of their illegal migration north. Unfortunately, because of the presence of gangs and just falling asleep at night and falling off the train, plus the conductor bumping the train back and forth a little bit to try to knock people off, many people fall off. Some people die. Some people get sucked under by the vortex of the wheels going so fast and lose their limbs. And that train is known colloquially by the migrants as the death train, El Tren de Muerto. And many people, as I say, become victims of the train, and then they get sort of stuck in limbo. Without limbs, they certainly can't continue north and try to get jobs in America. They can't stay in Mexico because they're illegal there, too, and they don't want to go back home because of the shame they feel, since they were supposed to go to the north and become breadwinners and send money back to the family. So we started a program a year and a half ago to repatriate death train victims from Tapachula, which meant that we helped them get prosthetics and job training and helped place them in their in a job situation back home where they could support themselves and their family.
Well, Dean, it seems like a lot of your efforts are directed toward rebuilding this world of coffee growers, and probably the focal point of that is free trade coffee. Would you give us a quick thumbnail of what free trade coffee is?
Well, I assume you're referring to fair trade coffee.
Oh, I'm sorry, fair trade coffee.
Not a problem. Yes. It's an easy mistake to make. But fair trade is a program that was started in Europe in the 1980s. And basically it recognizes that the small farmers at the end of the chain are very marginalized. They don't have access to markets directly. They don't have access to cash or credit. And so they are the poorest of the poor. So it originally was a way to find markets, money, and respect for most marginalized coffee farmers. On the farmer side, it required the small farmers to form democratic and transparent cooperatives in order for them to have bulk power and organized power and a lot of other wonderful things spin off from that, including democratic process, people having a voice for the first time, women being allowed to participate and taking full responsibility within an organization, which in some of these places is quite rare, so that's a wonderful thing. On our end, the people who abide by fair trade agreed that we will always pay at least a certain minimum price that has been agreed upon between the farmers and the NGOs in Europe as being a meaningful price that can keep food on the table, hopefully keep the kids in school, and allow for some progress. So that when the world price goes down below the fair trade minimum, we agree never to go below the minimum. When the world price goes above the fair trade minimum, we agree always to tack on an extra nickel to the price. Let me give you some real prices so we know what we're talking about. The fair trade minimum for organic coffee has been $1.46 for a while. It just went up to $1.50, and now it's up to $1.60. But it was $1.46 for about 15 years. So that meant when the world market price plus the country premium, I'm trying not to get too complex, each country has a quality premium, 30 cents or so. But when the world market price and the premium went below that $1.46, we agreed never to pay less than $1.46. When the price went above that, let's say if the world market price and the premium of the country was $1.50, we would agree to pay $1.55. So over the course of 98 through about 2005, the prices plummeted and went as low. On one day, they dipped as low as 35 cents market price. But it was roughly, you know, from 40 to 65, 40 to 70 cents for years. And that's where the real problem lies. The fair traders never dipped below $1.46 for organics or $1.21 for conventionally grown coffee.
So essentially, those of us who are buying fair trade coffee, a cup of fair trade coffee from a fair trade dealer, are helping those in the developing nations survive and prosper in a way that they would otherwise not be able to. That's
the objective. Well, you know, I'll tell you, Michael, I don't want to oversell it. You know, I want to be honest about it. Fair trade, for coffee farmers earning fair trade, nobody's driving around Cadillacs.
Okay, when we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk with Edwin Martinez, who is a coffee grower in Guatemala, and Dean Sikon, the author of Java Trekker and the World of Fair Trade Coffee. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. Please do stay tuned. We will be right back. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. What's in your cup of coffee this morning? Is it fair trade coffee? Right back. Please do stay tuned. Well, folks, what's in your cup of coffee this morning? I'll bet it's a lot more than you would expect. I'll bet it's a whole world of human enterprise focused on the developing portions of the world. Dean, is there any coffee grown in the developed nations?
Well, there is coffee in two U.S. areas. One is Hawaii and the other is Puerto Rico. Fair trade doesn't apply to Hawaiian growers because of U.S. labor standards and higher wages. So it's fairly well agreed that workers on plantations and small farms in Hawaii are at a living wage.
Uh-huh.
Also, there's no cooperatives in Hawaii. And one of the problems of the fair trade movement is, as I said before, it was meant to work with the most marginalized producers, and they form cooperatives. So if farmers are not in cooperatives, they can't participate in this program formally. Okay, it's not as I said, it's not meant to solve all the problems in the world. It's meant to address the issues of the most marginalized farmers. But I was at a World Trade Organization forum a couple years ago on fair trade. I organized the panel, and one of the brokers, the people who bring the coffee into the country, said, well, we can't pay fair trade prices to farmers because they're not in co-ops. And I said, well, what's preventing you from paying a decent price? You know, if you believe that farmers should be treated with respect and paid a decent price, why don't you just do it? Then you can tell people that you paid a decent price and you don't need somebody's label. You know, don't hide behind the label to say we can't pay farmers because we can't get that label.
Well, in Kona, I paid $35 to a farmer for his coffee, $35 for a pound of coffee. Was I crazy?
Well, here's the thing about Kona coffee. It's a limited amount,
right.
Okay? So it's a low supply with a high demand. There's your economics. Mm-hmm. The cost of producing coffee in the islands of Hawaii is much, much higher than the cost of producing coffee in the third world. Having said that, should they really get $35 a pound? I don't think so. Did they get it from you? Yep.
Yep. There's a sucker born every minute, and that would be me.
It's part of its marketing, and that's the story of Jamaican coffee.
Sure.
Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee, you know, you're paying the same $35 a pound for. Are the farmers getting, you know, $15? No. Are they getting $10? No. Are they getting $2? Maybe. I'll tell you another story. A large American chain of Swank coffee shops, which shall not be named, recently sold a special coffee from Ethiopia for $26 a pound. Well, the Sacramento Bee found out that the farm it came from, they had only paid, I think, $1.45 or something like that, or maybe even $1.60 for that coffee. But they turned around and sold it for $24 to $26.
Well, that's how they have a chain of swanky coffee shop restaurants. Well, Dean, when I put out the press release on the show about coffee, I received an email from Guatemala from Edwin Martinez, mm-hmm. who said that fair trade is a great idea but not sustainable. And Edwin is calling in today. So let's check in with him and see exactly what he has to. Edwin Martinez, welcome to the Food Chain. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good. Welcome to the Food Chain. So you are farming coffee in Guatemala?
Yes, we grow coffee in the highlands of Huehuetenango in northwest Guatemala.
Mm-hmm. And are you a fair trade coffee producer?
We don't sell through fair trade because, as Dean explained, one of the requirements is that you must be in a co-op.
Mm-hmm.
And also the co-op has a cap on the volume of coffee that the grower produced to be in the co-op. And we produce a little bit more than that. We're a mid-sized, kind of a rare-sized farm in Guatemala with a large majority of the farms are much smaller, but a lot of the coffee does come from farms that are also much, much greater.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever we bump into, we're either seen as a really big guy or a really small guy.
It seems like agriculture, like all businesses, growing in two directions, either very, very big and or very, very small. And everything in the middle seems to be roadkill, but you seem to be surviving. How big are you?
Well, to give you an idea, it is nobody grows coffee to make money.
Well said.
But the quantity of coffee that we produce is comparable to a very small berry farm maybe in the United mm-hmm. States that might barely be sustainable, that would be comparable to 15 to 40 acres.
Okay.
And that's the mid-size where farming in North America, I understand, is you have to be pretty big or in a co-op now to make it, whether it's dairy or berries or wheat or corn.
Mm-hmm. You know, the whole notion of a co-op is a hugely significant one in the history of agriculture. And Dean, you talk about Ethiopia and how at one time they had some very strong co-ops, and then the country became communist, and co-ops became something other than something to market your farm crops. Could you explain that a little bit? The evolution of that story?
Sure. You're right. Co-ops have been kind of a movement in the agricultural world, both here and abroad, basically since the 30s. And they had taken legs. They had taken root in a lot of the African countries for greater or lesser success because of corruption, bureaucratic politics, and everything else. But in Ethiopia, in the 70s, when the Derg, the Marxists, came into power, they used the co-op structure as a means for spying on people, recruiting children into the army because they'd know where the kids were. And so the farmers didn't really trust the co-ops. And then what happened after the Derg left, some very enterprising Ethiopians looked at the co-op structure, looked at its success in Japan, in the Netherlands, in the U.S., and in other countries, and said, hey, why don't we resuscitate our co-ops along democratic lines and see what happens? And they have, and they've been very, very successful. The largest one we deal with has 80,000 farmers in it. That's Oromia Cooperative.
Well, Edwin, why aren't you in a co-op?
We wouldn't be accepted in the co-op.
He's too big, for one thing. To be frank, in the fair trade movement, the cooperative language requires farms of, I think, no more than 5 hectares.
Which is about, ten acres or
ten
so?
10 acres, yeah. Listen, I don't, I have an issue with that. As I said, it's not a panacea.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was meant for the small farms that don't have any access to credit, and it stinks that the mid-level farms, just like middle class in America, is always the one that gets the end of the stick.
Right.
The big farms have plenty of support. They can get credit.
They own the government.
They're integrated. They own everything from the process and the growing to the processing, and maybe even have a hand in the exporting. The small farmers are getting some help from fair trade and nonprofit organizations, but like everywhere else in the world, it's the middle class that suffers. And I think what our friend is experiencing in Guatemala is the squeeze. So what those guys are doing around the world is doing something like wine and going for appellations, doing
right.
a development of a quality characteristic and profile of their coffee that sets them apart from the other Weiwei Tanangos. And Weiwei's got some great coffees. But, you know, if he's doing the right thing on that farm, and I'm sure he is if he's calling in on this program, then, you know, that's the market for him. And that's a booming market right now.
So I'm going to pick that up when we come back. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking coffee with the coffee people. Dean Saikon, author of Java Trekker, Dispatches from the World of Fair Trade Coffee. And also Edward Martinez, who is a coffee grower in Guatemala. We're learning all about what it takes to make a cup of coffee and put it on the table in front of you. So as you sip your cup of coffee this morning, give a look inside. Peer down in that dark liquid and see the swirling mists and see what's exactly involved in bringing that coffee to you. Right back.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Welcome back out there. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking coffee with the coffee people. We have Dean Saikon, who is the author of the Java Trekker, Dispatches from the World of Fair Trade Coffee. A great read if you want to take a peek into the world of coffee, but more than that, the world of the developing cultures throughout the developing nations. Dean, you traveled all over the world looking into these cultures. It seems like wherever you go, you're involved in some real primitive developing worlds.
Well, you have to understand, I'm not an author because I'm a journalist who wrote a book or somebody who had this idea to write
a
book.
You're a coffee guy.
I've been involved in indigenous rights and third world development issues since basically 1976. And in 1989, I co-founded an organization called Coffee Kids, which was the first nonprofit development organization in the coffee world. And it was my job to go into the coffee villages around the world, meet with farmers, meet with women's groups, meet with civic society, and really learn what was going on there and how the coffee industry might step up to the plate to help. From there, I came to the realization after a couple years that even though this was great charitable work, it wasn't about change. And coffee farmers needed more than charity. They needed some serious structural change. So I decided the best way to model that was to form my own for-profit business, because frankly, people don't listen that often to nonprofits, called Dean's Beans Organic Coffee, and to model how a business could be an effective partner in bringing progressive social, ecological, economic change to coffee villages around the world and still be profitable. Because if I did that, then I modeled, and no coffee company had an excuse to say, well, we're not making enough money this year, we can't give you anything, or we can't pay the farmers more money. And in the 14, now 15 years I've been doing Dean's Beans, we've proven that, A, there's so much money for people in the coffee world through this wash of money that flies up and down the chain. There's plenty to pay the farmers a fair trade price and beyond. This year, Ethiopian coffee is going for, to us, remember we talked about the $85.95
right.
dollar,
right.
Okay, fair trade price minimum is now $1.60. Ethiopian coffee this year is going for about $2.20 a pound.
Wow.
That is significant difference in price.
So does that really put a smile on the coffee grower's face?
Well, I was just in Ethiopia in November, and down in one of the villages in Yirgacheffe, which grows some of the best coffee in the world, and frankly, we stayed in the district coffee cooperative chief's head household, and it was basically a mud hut with not a lot to eat. And these folks have had fair trade for 4 years, their whole crop. So that's the best they could do with that. So as I said, people aren't buying Cadillacs from fair trade, but they are not suffering the malnutrition that I used to see in Yurgachev 5-6 years ago.
Let me ask Edwin Martinez, you're a grower in Guatemala. Listen, Edwin, caller wants to know if you were educated at the University of California or something, because you have this, you sound very, very American.
And well spoken.
I did go to a university in Los Angeles, Bio University, for 1 year. And then I went to a university in Washington State, in Bellingham. Western Washington University.
Good. So you're educated in the big cities, and does that help when you go back to a place like Guatemala and try to fight for a position in the world coffee markets?
Immensely. 6 years ago, when we began to try and export our coffee directly, I was essentially one of the first, probably the first person through the National Guatemalan Association of Coffee Growers. It's referred to as ANACAFE. The first of our size to export coffee directly. There's a big gap in logistics where the small farmers and mid-size all end up funneling through a handful of brokers, which after 6 years now, actually went around yesterday and visited most of them, and it was an incredible experience. But it was incredibly difficult to get our license. It took 6 months the first year of working on it nonstop.
And frankly, with his education and his brains, you were able to get that in 6 years. There are a lot of other small farmers in the other countries who can't get that license because it's so hard to obtain an export license. So congratulations.
Well, Dean, you tell a wonderful story about the specialty coffee convention, annual convention that's held here in the United States. And you tell a story about how some of the people from these co-ops in the developing world come to this convention and try to induce you into trying their coffee.
The Specialty Coffee Association of America, SCAA, annual conference, which takes place in April or May in a different U.S. city every year, this year it'll be in Minneapolis, is the premier opportunity for buyers, sellers, brokers, baristas, machine manufacturers, and every other kind of flim-flam man to get together in a trade show, which also has days and days of workshops on political issues, on technical issues. So it's the place to be.
Edwin, do you ever go to those?
Yes, I do.
I'm sure. Yeah, it's a major place. So what happens there is often, hundreds, if not thousands of farmers from around the world show up at SCAA to meet potential importers, to meet potential roasters, and to try to create relationships. And a couple of years ago, when it was in Boston, I tend to talk in some of the workshops, and I was giving a talk to the farmers about how you can present your product to the northern market, and it was a very skill-based workshop. And of course, afterwards, needless to say, hundreds of farmers came up to me. But what they do is, especially the small co-ops, they'll spend, it's just a couple of thousand bucks for airfare, hotels, etc. And when you're talking about someone who's making, maybe $2,000 a year at most, that's a lot of money to spend. So the co-ops pool together and they'll send three representatives with hundreds of little Ziploc bags full of the green coffee that they want to give to the brokers, importers, roasters to sample. And by and large, you get deluged with samples, and at the end of the SCAAs, the hotel rooms are littered plastic bags.
Okay, folks, going to take a quick break and conclude. When we come back, we'll be talking with Dean Sikon and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. When we return, we'll conclude and ask what we, you and I, coffee drinkers of the world, can do to help the developing world develop. Right back. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Dean Sikon, who is the author of Java Trekker and Dispatches from the World of Fair Trade Coffee. Dean traveled the world in pursuit of his coffee for his company called Dean's Beans. Dean, you talked a little bit about, or Edwin did from Guatemala. He said that nobody grows coffee for profit. So would that make it true that it's the middlemen who make the profit in this industry?
Well, yes. Yes, it is true. But I work with a lot of middlemen. I know a lot of middlemen, and their profit margins don't have to be really dramatic. Everybody takes a piece along the way. But I'll be honest with you, when I take a pie chart down to Guatemala, I was just in Guatemala last week visiting farmers and doing some other work in the Lake Atitlan area, which our friend knows well.
Mm-hmm.
The farmers are pretty much aghast when they see what they get, and then they see, of course, each step along the way and what it sells for at the end of the day.
And that's so, your primary sales, too, for joining for the co-ops to
yes,
become
it is.
Fair trade.
It is. Yeah. It's a good community organizing tool, and I did that in Papua New Guinea as well, and people said, oh, my God, you mean we've been getting 10 cents a pound for our coffee and we should be getting a buck and a half or something? Yeah, it's an eye-opener.
Let's go quickly to the phones and talk with Rich, who has a quick question. Rich, welcome aboard. Food Chain.
Where and when was the first cup of coffee drank? It was the process it goes through. How do they discover that we could drink this stuff? And who does Burger King buy their coffee from?
Good questions.
I'm happy to give the answer as far as we know, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in Ethiopia, about 1,500 years ago, or 1,200 years ago, a goat herd named Kaldi was on top of a hill near Jima, which I was at in November, and he was watching his goats kind of shuck and jive and dance and jump and jittery, and he looked and they had been eating these red berries from a plant. He took the berries to a local monk, because monks were the scientists of the day, and the monk looked at it and said, I don't know what the heck this stuff is, and he threw it in the fire. He said, it must be the devil's food, because it made the goats jump. So he threw it in the fire, and as the stuff burned, it let off an aroma, and he went, mmm. But it took it, you know, poured some water on it, and made a beverage out of it. Now, that's what I've always heard, and the Yemenis who claim no, it's not Ethiopia, it's Yemen that discovered the first cup of coffee, they say that's an invention of American marketers. So I checked that out. When I was in Jima, on that hill, standing there with one of the guys who's the guardian of the forest, you know, I said, look, I heard this story about Kaldi and everything, and, what, you know, is that true, or is that just sort of what the companies say? Is like Marcus Welby on TV standing up and saying, I play a doctor on TV. And he looked at me and he said, I do not know this good doctor, but I can tell you I heard that story when I was a child. Now, this guy was about 80. I heard this story when I was a child from my grandfather. So I know that that story goes back a long way before Marcus Welby and Maxwell House.
And the last question is, where do the big fast food franchises get their food?
Get
their coffee, yeah.
Okay, Dunkin' Donuts gets it largely from Mexico, if you want to know. It's a good coffee. It's a little sour, a little bitter, and that's the Dunkin' Donuts taste. Starbucks gets it from about half a dozen different countries, and everybody gets it from their own source. But
okay,
the large companies also blend it with the Robusta. Now, here's
to cut it. Well, we're out of time, Dean. Dean Sykon,
okay,
founder and owner of Dean's Organic Coffee, Dean's Beans, and author of Java Tracker. Boy, I could talk with you for 1,000 hours.
Well, I could drink a few more cups and keep going.
Thanks, Dean. Thank you for tuning in out there. This has been The Food Chain.
Good luck, Eduardo.
Been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.